Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
So in essence, what Omnichannel is a form of engagement. So when you take two, three steps back, it's a way of how you engage with your HCP audience. So that's the first step. But then if you see how it enables that engagement model, it puts the HCP at the center. And with HCP at the center, it means that we work in a meaningful, highly personalized engagement format. So that's the second characteristic. It's highly engaging. It's highly personalized. That also means that when you engage with that physician, that content is based on insights. So it's based on what that HCP finds important to him and important to his practice.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome back to the show. Today, we have Philip Vieth on the show. Philip is a highly regarded thought leader and global expert in omnichannel strategy, known for his commitment to transforming the way organizations execute omnichannel initiatives. With extensive experience collaborating with leading biopharma and late-stage biotech companies such as AbbVie, Takeda, Merck Sharp & Dohme, and GSK, Philip has partnered with commercial excellence, marketing, and medical teams to enhance engagement practices across the biopharma industry. In 2022, Philip founded Shift, a specialized consultancy dedicated to helping organizations develop robust omnichannel strategies, capability models, and operating frameworks. He's driven by a passion for empowering global and local teams to implement omnichannel campaigns successfully. As a seasoned trainer, Philip has shared his expertise with over 1,000 professionals in the biopharma sector, equipping them with the knowledge and tools to excel in omnichannel execution. He's also a sought-after international speaker, presenting at numerous conferences and webinars on the latest trends and best practices in the field. Welcome to the show, Philip.
Hey, welcome. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And this is a really interesting topic, one that Nari and I have been talking about, one that's been requested by the audience members. I'm super excited to get into this. But really, let's just start with the basics for me and maybe others that might be listening. I think this would be helpful to just really define omnichannel, especially in the biopharma context, because I hear the word all the time. I'm not sure I could give a great definition. You're the expert, so I'm really interested to hear how you define it for your clients.
No, and it makes sense, Ian. I think we've been discussing omnichannel and multichannel multiple times, and I think it really requires you to start from that beginning. So in essence, what omnichannel is a form of engagement. So when you take two, three steps back, it's a way of how you engage with your HCP audience. So that's the first step. But then if you see how it enables that engagement model, it puts the HCP at the center. And with HCP at the center, it means that we work in a meaningful, highly personalized engagement format. So that's the second characteristic. It's highly engaging. It's highly personalized. It really puts that physician at the center. That also means that when you engage with that physician, that content is based on insights. So it's based on what that HCP finds important to him and important to his practice. So when you bring that content perspective in it, it's not the same content for all. It's based on insights, landscape insights, sometimes data insights, and you bring that meaningful content to that physician. And you bring that in a way, and that's probably the most often used, it's a 360-degree way of interconnected channels. And now I get a little bit more in the technical side. When you engage with that physician, it's not through rep only. It's through multiple channels. So it means rep, it's webinar, it's advertising. And those channels, they are also interconnected. So when we sometimes launch in our industry a webinar standalone event, it also means in omnichannel that the CRM system would know what happens in that webinar event, that the rep would have that vision and that insights, and the marketeer would also know. That's a big chunk of the conversations we've had in the past with many in our industry, that interconnected piece, that technical element, that's key. And that generates the 360-degree view. And 360-degree view is very closely linked to omnichannel. It means that you know what that HCP individual is doing at every moment in time on every of these channels. Getting slightly more technical, when you want to know if it's Ian or if it's Nari or Philip, on the website, it means that you need to have an identity management. You need to know who is on that website. You need to know who has logged in into a webinar. So very important to HEP Omnichannel is that you would know which physician has experienced which content. And that's also how you can further personalize that experience. So HEP in the middle, very insights-driven, meaningful through interconnected channels and also gathering that data to continuously improve that experience. So it's like a bit of a long setup, which I just explained. So I hope it kind of makes sense to you guys as well.
No, that was great. I like especially that you started with, it's really about the HCP in the center of all of this. You mentioned one term that I think we talk about a lot as well, which is multi-channel. So how can you differentiate between multi-channel and omni-channel? And is one better than the other? Is more?
It's key, the last thing that you just said, because we always tend in our industry to say what is latest is always the best thing. So first of all, I want to say there's a room and there's a place and time for multi-channel that is even better or more fitting than omni-channel. But when I take a step back, like I said, as a marketeer, you have go-to-market challenges. Your market has challenges where you have like, okay, I've struggled to reach physicians, but maybe in specialty care, my focus is on finding patients or getting referrals. While in primary care, it's about scale and efficiency of your field force or in any different way. So these go-to-market challenges, they define your commercial model where you have reps or CAMs or even a full digital model. And basically your engagement model of choice, your EMOC engagement model of choice, should actually solve these challenges. And in some ways that can be multi-channel or omni-channel. So that's already kind of elaborating on if one is better than the other. What multi-channel does in a different way, it's slightly less mature. Slightly less mature in a way that it doesn't go as far as omni-channel. Instead of HEPs, it puts your content, your message at the center. So it's message-centric. And the direction how it works is also different. Multi-channel is a push kind of motion towards the HEP. So just imagine, like in pharma, we have regular new contents, new studies. What we do is we rework those studies into a campaign or a content mechanism, and we push that out to the market. That was multi-channel does. It stays consistent with a message, with a study. Is it an RWE study with certain outlines? And you want to push that to the market through multiple channels. That can be the rep. That can be a webinar. That can be an email campaign or a landing page or whatever. So you activate multiple channels that stay consistent with that message strategy. There is, I would say, a gray nuance between multi-channel and omni-channel, because once you start working with multi-channel and you do not have all of the channels interconnected, but somehow you start automating that multi-channel experience, you can do multi-channel by segment of customers. You can do, for example, multi-channel for your customers who are already prescribing and you know who those are. And then you can do a multi-channel campaign for the ones who are not yet prescribing. You couldn't say that this is full HEP centric, but it comes already one step closer to being meaningful, personalized, to that HEP audience. So it's not always that easy to put them in one box or the other. That's what I definitely want to say to the audience. There is this gray area. And I would say that about, I think 85% of the people that I talk to, when they talk about omnichannel, they actually mean multi-channel. So the term omnichannel, multi-channel is used pretty vaguely or pretty mixed up by our audience as well. The difficulty of jumping from multi-channel to omnichannel is pretty big when it comes to technology investment. When you need to connect all of these channels together, you actually need a few platforms to get there. So the investment technology-wise, martech-wise, is pretty big, but also adoption and education, it's significant from an omni-channel to multi-channel perspective. Because if I want to take you back to the angle of content, in multi-channel, you have one content piece, one master content, a study. If you go to the market, it's about safety, it's about your data on efficacy, it's about MOA, and you push that out. So everybody more or less gets the same message. When you talk omni-channel, it would mean that physician Ian or physician Nari would basically be at a different level of prescribing in the adoption funnel. So as a marketeer, you also need to make sure that for each level of that adoption funnel, you have your journey, your content ready. So, and that's the difficulty, right? There is this focus on channel interconnectivity. That is the difference. But for me, pretty fast, it comes to the marketeer and its content portfolio, because that's where the biggest challenge is. You need to be, if you really want to work hyper-personalized, there's a very big pressure on content and MLR and et cetera, et cetera. So what brings, what everything that comes with the content production. So I kind of elaborate a little bit more on this, Nari, because I think it's different to understand this. And even one step prior to multi-channel, you have channel centricity. And if I would see a tactical plan of 2025 of a Belgian affiliate, and I would normally see, oh, we're doing a webinar, we're having a local conference in May, and we're having a new detail aid by August. The focus is not on message. The focus is on a channel. It's on a deliverable. That's even one step prior to multi-channel. And I would say the majority of the markets where I work with are today still at that level. They still have this hyper focus on, we're doing a webinar. And if I would see a tactical plan of a multi-channel market, they would say, we have three cycles. In cycle one, we focus on efficacy as a message. In cycle two, we go into this message and we deploy this through the rep, through an email campaign, through a webinar. We do an advertising campaign for the physicians that we do not reach. We do this with Medscape, etc. So they see channel as a tactical deployment of that message. And that's, I think, already the difference on a tactical plan when you see that in a market.
Thank you, Philip. That was a really thorough explanation and also a little bit myth-busting of what omnichannel, multi-channel, and the step before then, I'm not even sure what we want to call that, means and doesn't mean. So that was really clear. You also explained that one is not necessarily better than the other because, first of all, it comes with requirements to actually have something to offer, investment, and also really commitment to see that through. So it may be appropriate for some cases, and in other cases, you may not have to go omnichannel at all.
No, take, for example, pre-launch. If you go in pre-launch and you say, okay, I want to raise that market on disease awareness, our commitment to patients, our commitment of the company to the therapeutic area, that message would be relevant to everybody. So you would build that message strategy and push that out in pre-launch to the market. And that's basically multi-channel by nature. The same thing with an advertising campaign. I'm oversimplifying, but it basically means that in pre-launch, most of the campaigns are multi-channel.
Yeah, and thanks for the clarification, because it certainly helped me understand the distinction between the two. And I think many of us probably use those terms interchangeably when maybe we shouldn't. When you describe omnichannel, and maybe we'll get into this a little further into the conversation, but the two things that jump out at me are really the investment, right? You know, financial and effort in terms of the MarTech or the marketing technology that needs to be in place to enable this. And then the implication is, if you're going to have a customized message for each target, each provider, based on where they are in terms of product adoption and their journey, the implications are that you have to have a lot of content customized to that target and where they're at. One size does not fit all. And of course, as you already mentioned, you need to create that content, get it through PRC or MLR. And there's certainly resource considerations as you take that on. So I guess my question then, based on that, is this kind of a big pharma play, or is there a place for small biotechs, small brands to still be able to benefit from some of the advantages that omnichannel might offer?
This is a really good question, because omnichannel is, in my vision, is more easy if you're a mid-sized or small pharma company. And I've worked with legacy companies as well, but I've also done setups, which is, I started labeling it virgin omnichannel. And basically it means you have your late-stage biotech that brings the first product to market. And where you said, Philip, look, we have nothing. This is the market we're going for. This is the TA. These are the markets that we have. How do we start? And you can start from scratch. Now, building an OC strategy from a white piece of paper, or working with a legacy big pharma company that has multiple instances of CRM, every market has its own setup. Every market has its own tech platform. Or when you can start with a virgin omnichannel setup to say, okay, we have one tech strategy for everything. And we use the same customer data. Everybody's picking IQVIA OneKey or is going for the Veeva customer set and not something mixed. That already gives you a huge benefit. So that's one. If you can start from scratch, that's a lot more easy. It's still highly complicated, but it's more easy than working in a legacy company. The second part is, as well, as I think we're now getting into a very interesting technology era in the next 5 years. Because if you look at pharma or biopharma compared to other B2B complex selling processes, our industry has not been helped by technology. If you look at what Veeva has done, and they have done great and amazing work, but they have basically equipped us with rep-centric channels. They've given us remote, Veeva-proofed email, the calls, CLM. It's only as of recently that they will go into giving us the right tools to go beyond rep channels. If you look at outsider industry, if you look at Marketo, ActiveCampaign, or HubSpot, these are CRM platforms where you can create web pages, landing pages, you can create automated email campaigns, drag and drop, and do CRM in one platform. If you work today in pharma, you need Veeva, you need IQVIA OC, you need Salesforce, you need to interconnect them. So we need to do a patchwork. But that will all change in the upcoming 5 to 10 years. I don't think it's that known with non-tech people. And by the way, I'm also non-tech, but I do observe the technology space. Veeva and Salesforce are having a divorce. That's basically what's happening. So Veeva in the past, they used Salesforce in the background. So what you had in Veeva CRM was built on a Salesforce platform. Now, what they've decided last year is that they will break up. So Veeva will no longer use the Salesforce backend. They will build their own full CRM system. It will look the same on the front, but in the back, it will be their own CRM. Because they separate, Salesforce will also come with their CRM, and they're partnered with IQVIA OC. So they're like two major platform networks that are arising, Veeva plus Salesforce separately. And because of the separation, Veeva will also come with an automation solution. So Veeva will also broaden the tools for both sales teams and marketing teams that they can also start automated campaigns in Veeva. And the other way around, Salesforce will come with a very compelling offering. They just had Dreamforce in September, a big conference. So the bottom line of this is that if you're a marketer in 23, 24, you had to use different systems to build an automated email campaign using landing pages, etc. That will all change. Campaigns will be able to be led by sales teams, by reps, but the marketer will be also an orchestrator of campaigns. They will also own their own campaigns in the upcoming years. Veeva and Salesforce will make that space. So for me, the biggest shift in the near future will be with those marketing teams. They really have an interesting future ahead. And you need to watch this space as a marketer, not for the tech, but to kind of see, okay, this is the new capabilities that will be deployed, and this is how it will change my role. Because if you look at non-pharma, B2B, you have sales and marketing, but marketing is owning their own campaigns. They do brand awareness, product awareness. But in pharma, most of the marketeers, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but they produce detail aids for a sales channel. They're a content supply chain. They're a content owner, but they're not an engagement, an orchestrator. And that's the biggest shift our industry will have in the upcoming years.
So can you expand on that a little bit? Comparing our industry with B2B, for instance, you just said there's more of a separation between sales and marketing teams. So it sounds like the sales teams are more owners as well as executors of their own campaigns, whereas we don't do that really in pharma. So you think that we're going to go the way of B2B in the future?
Yes and no. So first of all, if you would have a B2B marketeer here, he would be highly expert in segmentation, retargeting, building websites, really the engagement part of a marketeer and how you bring a product to market. I've been having quite some conversations with marketeers in the past weeks. These people are highly expert in their therapeutic area. That's the first on their list. They know oncology. They know immunology. They know that space. They know the KOLs in that market. That's their first background. Very little of them have an MBA in marketing. They have an advanced economics degree in marketing or digital marketing. It always has been a secondary or third skill and capability. So that's the first thing. So that their background, their foundation is very, very different. When you look at B2B, what of course is different is the most B2B sales and marketing work hand in hand in a funnel mechanism. So what marketing does is they go to the market. And I'll try to explain this with HEPs. And I'll try to explain this with a model I've designed, an engagement model I've designed for a rare disease company. It was a rare disease company that had about 30,000 patients in Europe. 50% of them were in treatment centers, and they would know where those patients were. And 50% of those patients were outside of treatment centers. So it was a rare disease, but not super rare. And the question was, look, Philip, if we have 15,000 patients in Europe outside of treatment centers, we're not able to build this with a rep model. We're not able to put reps in the field for this volume of patients. We need to come up with something different. And that's, again, that engagement model of choice. So I designed a funnel mechanism. And a funnel mechanism would be is, okay, if we engage with HCPs in this therapeutic area, you engage with them, you try to identify them. So instead of having banner ads where you know the number of clicks, you want to know, was it Ian? Was it Nari who clicked on this? You want to go to identifying. So based on the content we put out, you can then start track people who click on an ad and bring them to a webinar, bring them to a landing page where you identify them. And that's still the marketing territory. It's still owned and orchestrated by marketing, from going from unidentified to identified traffic. It's always top of the list of a marketeer. You do not want to know the volume. You want to know who you're talking to, because in that way, you can retarget them with a campaign. In Europe, you can ask for their consent. And only when they're highly engaged, you bring them to the sales channel. So this means that how you attract them highly engaged, it's what's called a lead scoring. A lead scoring is very common in B2B. It's qualifying a lead. Basically, the HEP that I'm talking to is highly interested. He's got a high scoring. He's seen our webinar. He's downloaded a white paper. He's opened a few emails. Now he's ready to be addressed by a rep. So you build a funnel mechanism where marketing plays its role in the early funnel, and then they hand over to sales. And that's also how any B2B company works. You only put sales into action with a lead that is worth engaging with. But basically, how our rep models sometimes work is we knock on every door, and everybody who opens, we talk to, or we try to talk to. So it's a very, very different model. And I see the biggest customers who make really great progress are the customers who are also active in consumer health, in primary care, and in rare disease. So in some of the specialty areas where it's been always a rep-first model, they tend to go slower. That's my observation. So even within a company, you can have pockets or therapeutic areas or areas which move faster. That's, for example, why I don't believe in these. When customers say to me, yeah, Philip, can you tell me which of the companies are moving faster? Who's leading this? And we all know these lists of some of my peers and consultancy companies that kind of rank companies. It doesn't make sense. If I look at my customers, even within the customers I work with some markets, with other ones I don't. It's very difficult to be so precise on companies leading this and on even within that company, TAs or some countries doing better than others. So these ranking lists, I'm not a big fan of it.
So let's talk about how a company would get started on their omnichannel journey, let's say. And so if you think about a small to medium-sized biopharma company that realizes this is important, it's a gap within the organization, they really want to make a commitment to omnichannel for all the right reasons. You know, I'm imagining there's a few different ways you could go about that, and I'd like to get your perspective. I suspect you might have a biased opinion on this a little bit, but here's my take on it, right? You can try to build that skill set among your existing marketers. Is that possible? Do you have kind of inline marketers that can learn the technology, learn the skills, and you build that capability within the organization? Option two might be you hire in talent, right? Folks that have done this successfully at other organizations. And then option three is maybe they call somebody like you at Shift to help them get started, whether that's building the functionality or supporting it through an external kind of consultant relationship. But how should we be thinking about that? Or are there other options that I should be thinking about as well?
No, I think it's a good question. It would take you approximately 3 to 4 years to achieve something. And I've designed something which is a standard roadmap of where you would start. And of course, this is different with any company, but there's a few principles that I hold pretty dearly. One of them is, I do not train to start with. I do first, and then I train later. And I'll explain you why. If I would explain to my 4-year-old daughter the theory of riding a bike without actually having to ride a bike, she would not understand because she have never seen a bike. She doesn't know how it works. And then when you look at change management, there's a few ways of getting people to change, right? One is them, you educate them, you give them a graduation, you sign it off, like how we go to university, and only then you can start doing. The other one is you give my four-year-old a bike, you close the door, or you put her out on the road and you say, good luck, and you see what happens. That wouldn't work either. Now, what I do is I do guided execution. And the first step, I build something which is called a minimal viable campaign. And that would be, even without raising the bar on your capabilities, I would say, look, guys, what do we have to work with? We have a CRM, we have remote, we have webinar, we have a congress that we're doing. And maybe not everything is interconnected, but we would build a first campaign with what we have. And that could be sometimes a bit bootstrap. We could mimic personalization. We could even mimic automation on a very small scale. The fact is, if I start with training, or I start with, oh, we're going to highlight ambassadors or champions, it would probably push me 6 to 8 months before I have the ambassadors validated, I trained everybody. And if you would then come to me as a CMO, say, Philip, great, we've been doing this for 8 or 9 months. How do we move the needle with HCPs? It's a very tough question to answer. So if you then start with MVC, with a minimal viable campaign, you almost get a better feeling about what does it take to do a campaign. And I work with this campaign one pager where you say, okay, this is my campaign objective. I want to raise disease awareness. I want to do this to all physicians, or I want to do a different targeting and audience. So the question of to who am I bringing this message, you cannot believe it takes me quite some time to solve it, to see how do we rely on our profiling? How do we rely on our segmentation? Then we go into what's the message we want to bring to that audience? Which channels do I activate? How would that journey look like? Which KPIs are we tracking? And all of these boxes, they feel pretty natural. But in this one pager, I bring together insights team, a marketing team, an analytics team, a commercial excellence orchestration or engagement lead, and of course, a marketer or a medical person. So it's about that minimal viable campaign. And that's the first thing I do, focus on execution and train later. The second part, which is also a principle, is when we start building capabilities, we do not build tech for tech. Because if you put people like me and our peers together, we probably would go, oh, we need this and we need this. But it's basically all of the bells and whistles of the amazing tech that is available. But if I bring all of the bells and whistles to a company and they hardly get used, it doesn't make sense. So how I work is, I basically say, like, if I would have your tactical plan 2025, which are the most important moments for you today? How do you work? And if you say to me, look, Philip, Congress experience is really key, or we work with medical education because that's what our product and our market needs, then we're going to say, okay, and what would be the great and ideal experience of a Congress? Okay, when I'm at a booth and I see a physician, I want to be able to have consent on a mobile way, to have his consent and follow up with him, or already book a meeting and really have a good follow-up from booth to after the booth. That's something. Or when I do a webinar, I want to understand who is at the webinar and follow up in a personalized way. So these are all of use cases. These are examples of experience. What I then do is I describe these examples, and then we're going to find the technology to be able to execute these. This means that I'm going to build tech for something that marketing finds valuable, what medical finds valuable, and not because a few omnichannel nerds thought that would be amazing to do. And I think that's also to C-level to say, look, guys, we're looking at it as an entrepreneur. We're building stuff we need, and it can be stuff we need today, but also slightly ahead of time, looking forward. But we're not building it because we think it's cool or because we want to say at a conference, look, this is what we built, and this was way beyond anybody else that has built this. So really the window dressing, the kind of bling kind of projects that you sometimes see, which we now kind of have with AI sometimes. So that focus on do first, train later, and building capabilities then with really that focus on use cases. And the third one is I start my projects in stealth, because omnichannel, most of the companies I work with have done omnichannel projects. They've done it 2 or 3 times, and sometimes they didn't get the output they expected. So I start in stealth. I start only in a few markets. And when I work with reps, because I know I go pretty far in the organization, when I work with reps, I do not work with all of the reps from the beginning. I work with the reps that are really saying, okay, I want to do this. I want to try this out. And the ones that are skeptical, I do not take the time at that stage to convince them. I will do later on, but I just want to get something done and show we are doing this. And those first steps that you take, they would probably seem, oh, that's a very easy, basic campaign. So in most cases, in a rep model, that would mean I'm doing rep plus two or three automated emails, and every email leads to a different call to action and a landing page. Stop. But just imagine it's like running for a marathon. That first campaign is your first 5K. So if it feels too easy, that's the one you need.
So it sounds like, Philip, you basically want people to get a taste for what this could be, not overwhelm them with giving them everything, but meet them kind of where they are and just start doing something. And then you can always do more. That's easier. But to get over that first hurdle of just getting your hands dirty, so to speak.
Yeah. And then you could have peers talking to peers, right? You could have the Canadian market to the French people saying, guys, this is what we've done and this is the result. And it's not Philip or any consultant bringing in the news, but it's peer-to-peer. And that's, like we know, it's the biggest value. And only then you start doing more of the same. We're doing more of the same volume. And only then I increase more difficult campaigns. And then you start to bring in new capabilities. So if you look at Omnichannel, you have these people that are building the capabilities, the builders, that's commercial excellence. You have people owning the content, you have people owning insights. If you start focusing on the building from the beginning, I mean, it takes really a lot of time to have the RFPs. So basically I say, guys, let's start with what we have today and focus on content experience or doing something different. And that's something that I learned throughout the years. If I would go back 3-4 years, I would put automation pretty far at the end of my maturity model. I now tend to really pull in automation from the beginning. I'm able to do an automated campaign after 3, 4, 5 months. And you can do this in a bootstrap way. You do not need to buy any tech. You can just buy an automation platform and upload an Excel list where you have consent, for example, or in the US, it would be slightly different. But it means that with bootstrap, you can have impact or try out capabilities pretty fast. So this is not something that is so far away. And automation will help you in a lot of ways, because I think we've all seen these kind of subway maps of orchestration where they say, okay, in the beginning of your launch, you do this, and then you have this arrow going to the next email and then to the next. If you're a rep and you're doing 7 to 8 calls a day, let's say 30 to 35 a week, and they say every time you visit a physician, 2 days later, you need to send a Veeva-approved email, and then 3 days later, you need to do this and that. I mean, this is just basically impossible. It's a hassle for these people. So what I say to reps is, guys, you will have the same insights. You will have the same KPIs, but we're going to do the work for you and we'll get them involved. The way that I sell this to the reps is saying, guys, you are Cristiano Ronaldo. Cristiano Ronaldo is like, you have 10 guys playing football for you. You only score, but we're going to make the other channels work for you. And you will be updated on the content, what we're sending out as automated email or websites. You will see it. You will be in control. In some cases, we also give the rep the chance to trigger or stop the campaign. And we'll give you transparency. When you open your Veeva CRM, your timeline, you will see what has happened to that HEP and the emails. So it's control, transparency, and trust that you want to build with that rep audience. And then it really works. Because it's not omnichannel, if you deploy it, it is not. It's changing the game also for reps. It's not taking away their role, but we can also help them to become smarter the next time they go in. Because they will know more. They will know if the HEP joined a webinar, if he opened that email on efficacy, or if he needs to start again because he didn't see that video on efficacy, and that's where he needs to pinpoint his message. So it's a lot more easier to say, guys, my value proposition is I'll make you more smart.
So what are some of the watchouts here for companies kind of starting down this road? What are the things that are common mistakes or the landmines that sometimes companies step on as they're trying to do this work? What advice would you have for what to avoid or what not to do so we can learn from some of the mistakes?
So I think, like I said, right, execution is probably the biggest challenge of our industry in omnichannel. Most of them are talking about, oh, you need multiple channels, you need to integrate them, capability. And I see this tendency of waiting until everything is there to actually start. If you wait until the perfect tech strategy, the perfect tech setup, and we're not doing it because it's not all integrated, that's not it. So actually focusing on executing is key. The second one is, once you start executing, you see pretty fast that content becomes the biggest bottleneck. So understanding your content supply chain, your MLR process, and how you can deal with that is key. And even one step before that content piece, because I said to you in one of the calls we had, I do not take on any assignments when it's only commercial excellence. I only work together with commercial excellence and marketing, and when marketing has as much skin in the game than the person of commercial excellence. So if marketing is not there, if the countries have the feeling that you're doing an OC pilot and it's like something parallel compared to their cycle plans, that's not good. You really need the full backup of marketing. And then addressing cycle plans, it's the other biggest challenge is, and that's probably why some of the companies get stuck into pilots. Doing it once is easy. Doing it several times becomes more hard, and integrating it into your way of working, that's probably where you start seeing that you're missing a few roles. And it's only when if you would start in June of 2025 and you're building your full strategic plan for 2026, that's the moment in time to start integrating the thinking about engagement. So if your marketing team builds their engagement plan and their global tactical plans, and later on the countries do a tactical plan, the templates that you use, for example, they should really push people to think in campaigns and not in, we're doing a webinar, we're doing a podcast. So it's one of the biggest accelerations or elements that you can scale your omnichannel way of working is integration in that global to local strategic process. It will really help. And then, of course, there's the incentive plan for the reps. There's supporting it from leadership with the right key messages, educating leadership on the returns on omnichannel in a different way than you would address with a sales manager. And then, of course, that education and how you educate with marketeers on what omnichannel is and their role to play is different. And then the last, I know this is very important to you guys as well, is the data. If you go to a noisy market, rheumatology, immunology, and you say, okay, we need to cut through the noise. It's about volume and frequency of touch points. This means that the data you generate, some of the campaigns that I do are 8-9 months long with 8 different landing pages, 8 or 9 emails. They generate a lot of data on open rates, click-through rates, time spent on page, or how many minutes of that video they saw. But this means that you also need somebody who looks at that data. So when we generate a dashboard, because everybody wants the dashboards, right? But it's about, what do I read on the dashboards? And it's not about, is that email performing? Your KPI model is not about channel performance. We're not in the business of being performant with email or performant with video. We're in the business of conveying a message. So you need to take that step from channel performance to message performance. So if you are message-centric, okay, we talk about safety. The question is, how much did a priority physician of your segment A, how much did they see the safety message in email, in a website, in a video, in an infographic, etc.? That's the key, because it's only then when you can really understand, like, okay, this person has been engaging with that message. They have been viewing that content and that high quality content. So I think that's the key element. And you need to go from consolidating the analytics of the campaign into visualizing it, but then there's the interpretation. And we do see that the marketing teams are like surprised, but who's owning that dashboard? Who will be interpreting it? Because it's a new role that is appearing now. And then who's taking action? Who is then modifying the second and third campaign with those learnings? And it's probably one of the things that you realize only when you start executing that you have certain gaps in roles and responsibilities that are appearing. And one of them is, as I said, the data owner, highly analytic. The second one is also the role of an orchestrator. Once you start doing more complex campaigns, the marketeer, the local marketeer, he also needs to take on the role of I'm producing content and doing the MLR and working with content agencies, but also being able to orchestrate and to design campaigns from held by somebody from an engagement role, but they need to take on a slightly more orchestrated role. So these are differences and challenges that you will have to face. It's not an easy topic. It really is hard. And when you talk to B2B, the challenges are not that different. They also struggle with, okay, we want to go into personalization. The volume is rising. We have more data. So I don't see a lot of connections with B2C. I would not look into the B2C market, but I would look into people with a complex buying process in B2B. that have a pretty long journey before they acquire a customer. That is really, once they acquire a customer, that is built on relationship, education, nurturing that customer. For example, tech platforms. Those customers and those B2B marketeers are pretty close and really understand the challenges that we have.
I absolutely agree. This is a very complex topic. And thank you for breaking it down for us. I mean, it's something that we probably all need to not only learn more about, but learn how to do more in the future. You just described how the role of marketeers is going to change and how there are skills that we don't all have right now that we need to acquire in the future. To throw even more complication in here, one question I have for you, and you kind of mentioned AI. We're now in a time where we have a lot of data and we have a lot of information, but the question is, how do we extract insights from that? And then one step further, how do we apply those insights in real time to something like a successful omnichannel campaign? Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think everything on insights, it will shift in the upcoming years with the whole dynamics with Veeva and Salesforce. And there's a few other platforms out there as well, by the way, beyond Salesforce and Veeva. I think what I see from, especially from Salesforce in the Dreamforce conference, is we will go into embedded AI. Because now we go to ChatGPT. If we need something, we go to a more isolated tool. We'll step into a second or a third wave where AI is embedded in basically what we do. And you'll already see this with some features and with the integration, for example, ChatGPT being integrated with Canva, ChatGPT working with other tools. So we'll go into this embedded AI, and that will also help. So Salesforce will work completely with embedded AI, and Veeva is setting up a slightly different approach and strategy. They will work with an AI partner program. So they will partner within the industry to have AI partners work with them. That's on the AI topic. Everything on analytics, it comes again also to this interconnected channels, right? So if you want to know what is happening in webinars and websites and emails, everything on live analytics, what I see people doing today is most of them are patching everything together in what they call a data warehouse. So they put all of the data into it, and then across channels, there's not really live for live analytics with most of the customers. They have it with a webinar. You can see, okay, with these webinar invitations, so many signed up, etc. So in that channel, in that isolated moment, this will change when you start working with a customer data platform. Customer data platform like Salesforce has with Data Cloud, but there's also Treasure Data, Telium, these are other brands. And what a CDP does, it works as an umbrella, and all of your channel and activities, some can be in CRM, some can be on websites, some can be in a webinar tool like ON24 or SpotMe, they basically are being collected in that umbrella. And they will do the same as a data warehouse, store everything, but they will also do improve quality, and they will also allow you to action on it. So just imagine, and I'll do this with an e-commerce example. So we've all been there. We go into an e-commerce platform and we buy some clothes and we drag them into our shopping cart, but then we forget. The kids are yelling, I go downstairs. Then afterwards, you get retargeted based on your actual engagement because they say, hey, Philip, didn't you forget about this? The same thing could happen when you buy something. I'm a cyclist, so I buy now winter stuff. And when they see that I bought maybe new winter gloves, they can see, okay, maybe Philip doesn't only need winter gloves. He also needs a hat or he needs socks or whatever. And this means is that you're being retargeted based on your actual engagement. So it's not based on how we work in pharma. We do profiling, we do segmentation model, and we rely on the rep. And that is basically what a CDP does. It's called dynamic segmentation, where you say, okay, I'm just going to build a new campaign. And I'm going to build a new campaign for everybody who's participated in one of our last three webinars. So I'm going to actually use the actual engagement. And I'm going to do a campaign called Webinar Lovers. Or I'm going to do all of the people that have engaged with RWE campaign through various channels. So it allows you to retarget. And this is, for me, one of the biggest shifts of marketeers. It's not a static role anymore. It's not, I produce my content and I release it two or three times a year in a cycle meeting. It's something that needs day-to-day work. And the CDP thing is pretty complex. I was working on it in 2019, 2020. It's not that easy. Your organization needs to be there and ready to also deploy it. The next 5 years, marketing and pharma, is really a roller coaster, and it will be driven by new tech opportunities. But if I go to the tech conferences, like the Dreamforce ones or the Viva conferences that's now in Europe, I don't see that many marketeers. The marketeers today are not drawn to these tech providers, and they shouldn't know the tech, right? Integrations, implementation, or deployment, but they should look at it with the goggles and say, okay, what is my takeaway? How is it shifting and impacting my role? And it goes for medical and marketing, right? Because from that angle, it's as value for the medical team as well.
All right. So, Philip, my last question to you is, this was very in-depth, and depending on where you stand, either it kind of exhilarating as a look into the future or terrifying as covering omni-channel, omni-everything, our HCPs and their actions. Because I think the example that you gave was very, very good. Probably happened to all of us where you leave something in a cart and then you get a ping. Haven't you forgotten to do something here? Didn't you want to check out? And so it sometimes feels like everything you do is being watched, which is probably not that far off from the truth. But there's a big difference in terms of how much data we can actually get on HCPs in the US versus ex-US. So do you see these potential enhancements or opportunities unfold in the same way in different areas of the world?
So it's basically US and everything outside US is two different fields, right? It's two different games. In Europe, of course, we have the element of consent, but I think it's a tendency that will continue in other markets. So everything about data privacy and if we can connect with physicians, that will continue to spread. And what sometimes even people forget is GDPR is a European legislation, but it's even different in market. So the German, Spanish, and Italian GDPR, how they apply it, are even more granular. To give you an example, in Germany, when you ask for consent, you need to have double opt-in. So you ask first consent, and then somebody needs to reconfirm on that consent level. But for example, everything, especially when you want to bring it back to ROI, is my engagement model paying off in the perception, in the intent to prescribe, or on sales data? We don't have that granular sales data. So that's something that is requires something different. And that's why in Europe, we use proxies for ROI. We use different ways and methods to see, is this engagement model having impact? And you can do this with isolated pilots, or what I mostly do is I work with third-party providers that are then checking in with HCP saying, how well would you rate company X and how well would you rate the most important companies on this topic? And if you then have done campaigns on this topic, you could see if you made progress in being perceived amongst competition, amongst other companies in that therapeutic area, if you're more leading or if you're following or if you're less known for this key message or this characteristic. So that's, we use proxies for ROI. And of course, the big channel that is media and everything that comes with media and advertising is so big in the US compared to Europe. That's, I think, also a very big difference that I see. Everything which is on ad spend, media spend, it's significantly bigger in US overall. So I think that expertise is very different. But for example, Canada, which is as a neighboring country, Canada is in a lot of setups, Canada is being held within Europe. I think some of the companies are having a UCAN model. Canada is pretty similar to, for example, France. They need to not only have MLR, but they also have like PAP, which is the government reviewing content as well, similar to France. And of course, there's the size, right? The size of the market and the impact they have in the conversation. That's pretty different as well. So it's basically only the US that is an odd one out. Everything else on automation, on go-to-market, on how do we find reps and have them combined with digital campaigns, with rep campaigns, all of these channels on personalization and content, they are similar.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for your time and all your insights. A really fun discussion. I learned so much. We do like to leave our listeners with a common question across all of our guests. So we'll ask you the same thing. But is there any event or any person that's been particularly motivating for you, or when you think back, has provided insights or guidance that has shaped your personal or professional life? We always like to leave on a positive note.
There's multiple people that come into my mind, right? But I think it's definitely a whole range of people at Galapagos that when I was building the Virgin Omnichannel during COVID, that really made an impact with me. And it's also because it's, as we said, omnichannel is not that easy. And everything, how I do things today is not only based on feeling, on learning from other people, but it's also of the mistakes you made in the past or things you would do differently today. That's how we grow in what we do, right? So like I said, I have done automation, pushed it away while I now pull it more closely and start from the beginning. And I think there's a whole range of people in the Galapagos team that really have been supportive of trying to move the industry and trying to be bold in trying to do something new. And I think that that's a really great atmosphere to work in when you have a team that is really embracing that bold move. Let's do this. Not knowing that it's per se will be successful, but we really want to push ourselves into a new venture. I think that has been really amazing. I think that's been really amazing. Challenging and hard work. But that's, I think, why we're in it for. It's a highly complex industry with a very interesting market mechanism, with market access, with payers, with HEPs prescribing, with a patient that in Europe we don't engage with. The dynamics of our industry are so complex, but the return, what we can do for patients when we educate our HEPs, when we engage with our HEPs in a better way to make them better at what they do, I think is so valuable.
Well, thank you for that.
A little bit of a Belgian connection going on here. Yeah, totally exactly. Unbiased.
But I love that aspirationally. I think that's, yeah, where we all would hope to be in the future for those of us that are just thinking about and trying to embrace, understand, and adopt and execute on omnichannel strategies. So wonderful discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Philip.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Nari.
Well, that was a really fun conversation with Philip. And I realized how much I actually didn't know about omnichannel or had some misperceptions, let's say, about what omnichannel was or was not. But obviously, a really interesting area and one I think we all should be, if not focused on, but thinking about in the future, because clearly the future is coming and omnichannel is part of it. And I think, you know, in our day-to-day lives, one of the things I was thinking about is perhaps this explains why I might be in conversation about thinking about buying something or shopping online. And then for the next 2 weeks, my Instagram feed continually shows me ads for that thing that I mentioned or that thing I was shopping for. And if we were ever wondering why that occurs or how that occurs, I think omnichannel is part of the equation there for sure.
I was wondering about that too. It's sometimes a little bit too much where it feels like you're constantly being watched and Big Brother is just there. So I wonder if we'll get to the point where HCPs also feel the same way and it's actually going to backfire a little bit. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. I think he really explained omnichannel in such a tangible way that was very helpful. But I'm really curious to see, a little bit like when we talked about AI, what this is going to mean for our industry.
Yeah, you know, I think you bring up an interesting point about, is it going to be perceived as intrusive?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we all don't like, I don't think any of us like the idea of that we're being watched or monitored or kind of the algorithm is figuring out our likes and dislikes. And I think that is something we'll have to think about with HCPs to make sure we don't overextend on this and do more harm than good. Although, you know, just to share maybe one kind of analog here, usually if you were to ask HCPs, do they want to see more reps or fewer reps or rep visits? Most of the time they're going to say fewer, right? They feel like there's too many reps and too many of them talking about the same thing, and they feel like that is intrusive. However, we know, you know, if we're doing it right, despite their opinions, often the rep or the personal interactions can be quite effective. So you do have to kind of find the right balance promotionally that gets you the outcome you're looking for without kind of turning off your customer, and that's not an easy thing to do.
The real question is, do you buy the things that your ads suggest?
Yeah, I think I am a victim of their algorithm, if that's the right way to put it.
So there you go. Omnichannel works.
Unfortunately, I must say it has worked. Yeah.
And on that note, see you next time.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye now.
Bye. And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in, and remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.